Back in April, the Federal Office of Personnel Management, OPM, discovered a breach on its data network. Now, the OPM is basically the federal government's human resources department. It manages background checks and job applications for millions of potential federal employees. The Obama administration investigated and released the results earlier this month. It was likely the biggest government data breach in history. More than 21 million people compromised. Now, the United States has one of the best cyber defense systems in the world, but the breaches continue, not just on government systems, but more commonly at companies, the ones that hold our credit card information, our social security numbers, and in some cases, even secret dating habits. So American intelligence officials say they're coming up with a new strategy. Here's Director of National Intelligence James Clapper speaking to NBC News Tuesday.
We are in the mode of reacting to these attacks, assaults, this purloining of intellectual property, et cetera. And until such time, though, as we can come up with some cyber norms, which include some form of deterrence, which people recognize and respect, this will continue.
Is that a tactical shift there? Deterrence, going on the offensive to prevent cyber attacks? Do we need a new cyber doomsday device?
Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack.
Thanks, Peter Sellers. So what does cyber deterrence look like in this era? And would it prevent attacks like the ones we've been talking about? Joining us is Peter Singer. He's the author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War and the new novel Ghost Fleet. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Peter Singer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So a bit of Dr. Strangelove there, obviously the conceit. A doomsday device in the old world is a giant nuclear bomb or a bunch of them on submarines or somewhere else. I get that. What does a doomsday deterrent in cyberspace look like? And how do you tell other countries that you have it?
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that we're looking for, I would argue, the wrong lessons from the Cold War. So, you know, in many ways, if there is a parallel to the Cold War, it's that early period where we actually took the real world versions of Dr. Strangelove seriously rather than laughing at him right now. So, you know, essentially we need to distinguish between someone trying to steal your secrets versus someone trying to carry out, you know, an actual act of cyber war, an actual, you know, as they jokingly call it, cyber Pearl Harbor, 9/11, whatever, where you're actually causing physical damage, people dying and the like. And so when it comes to secrets, that's unfortunately part of the game, the back and forth. You're not going to, you know, be able to prevent any kind of, you know, this espionage from ever ending 100%. So you're not looking here for some kind of overwhelming response. You're looking for both what they call deterrence by denial, where it's keeping the other person from accomplishing their goals. That's why they don't attack you. And in cybersecurity, whether the attacker is espionage, whether the attacker is crime, whatnot, what you're really looking for is not so much deterrence, but resilience, the ability to just power through it, to shake it off. So in many ways, you know, the lessons we should be taking here are not from Dr. Strangelove, but jokingly, in many ways, from Taylor Swift.
I assume you mean shake it off.
Yes. And the idea of what I'm saying here, and, you know, half joke, but in serious, is the magic word in cybersecurity is resilience. It's how do I power through the attack? How do I make the attack not matter? So the example would be with the OPM, they get inside my systems, but so what? They don't actually get easy access to records of 21 million Americans. Or the example with Sony would be, yes, they get inside, but you aren't knocked offline completely. You aren't like a turtle on your back. And so again, there's lessons here. If we're going back to the Cold War, it's not mutual assured destruction, because you're not going to get it in cybersecurity with the US. We are the most vulnerable.
I've noticed that one of the reactions to these repeated attacks, as bad as they are, is to say, well, we believe the Chinese are behind it. We believe Russia's behind it. And our mind goes to state actors, the Chinese government or Vladimir Putin running a shop that's fomenting these attacks. In reality, it could be criminal gangs, like you said. The variety of different groups, governmental, non-governmental, or quasi-governmental, that could be doing this seems so broad that knowing who to attack and how becomes inordinately complex.
Indeed. And that's why if you're looking for Cold War parallels, the parallels that you're looking for are trying to establish the norms of who can play, who can't, and what are the kind of actions that I may not like you doing to them, doing them to me, but they're at least acceptable in some manner. So if you go back to during the Cold War, the CIA and the KGB competed really hard. They certainly didn't like that each other was stealing secrets, but they also created certain kind of rules of the game in terms of, you know, we can't go around killing each other's agents all the time. We have to be able to keep this espionage game from escalating into something dangerous. And that's the same kind of norms that we're going to need to be able to build with, say, a China, which is, you know, look, we don't like you stealing our secrets, but there's other things that neither side should do because it will endanger us in getting into an actual war.
Before we let you go, Peter Singer, what concrete steps can we take? You know, if Russia and China, I use sort of the capital R and the capital C there, have decided that their strategy is to keep things from getting to the line of real confrontation. It's annoying. It's illegal. We don't like it. We complain about it, but it's nothing that's going to provoke stealth bombers over their territory, and they know that. How do we change where the line is to change their incentives for attacking us? You've already said we can make it harder so that you're not going to necessarily get as much of what you want if you break into Sony's servers. But what else can we do to really make them feel like it's not worth their time?
So there's three levels here. The first, as you hit it, is resilience. Make it harder for them so that they aren't incentivized to go after you. The second is to try and create some costs for them in other realms. So for example, there is an upcoming approval needed by the US government for a Chinese purchase of a major American software company. We may want to communicate, hey, you were going to gain this value, you're not going to be, because of the both the risk to us of you having control of this system, and then also this is what comes when you steal our secrets. And the third is to try and create norms on an international level so that it's not just, this is not just a US-China or a US-Russia game. It's about the broader global economy, where we start creating norms that, hey, if you want to be a player in the international economy, you can't be out there simultaneously using your state government and state link groups to steal secrets.
Peter Singer is the author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War. He's got a new novel. It's called Ghost Fleet. Peter Singer, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.